my life, it's been pounded into me that great power and impact will come to me if I radically pursue loving, accepting relationships with others. My parents were the first to teach me that and mostly modeled that for me. And though I was raised in the pre-Thomas the Train generation, thank you, Jesus, which is an honest reaction because we just babysat our 2.5-year-old grandson for 43 days last week. And after 100 episodes of Thomas, or maybe it was just one episode 100 times, just watching that little blue steam engine with those shockingly huge eyes, I zoned out, to be honest, because in my day we had real models of love. Captain Kangaroo, Leave It to Beaver, and Dennis Menace, who were just as faithful then as that little engine is now to sing to me and teach me about love. My spiritual leaders also taught me the biblical command to love. The Apostle Paul, for example, said, these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love, adding later, follow the way of love, eagerly desire the gift of love. Just saying, I've never known a time when I haven't been inundated with songs and posters and Facebook posts, all extolling the virtues of love. And since I grew up in the 60s, when people painted flowers on vans and jeans and anything else that didn't move, we carried anti-war signs pleading to make love, not war. When rock and rollers pled with us to live in love, come on, people now. Smile on your brother, everybody get together. There's a much milder version. What the world needs now. All right, that's going to put us to sleep. A pastor in that very generation put it this way. Love is the one ingredient of which our world never tires and of which there is never an abundance. The world will never outgrow its need for love. Every voice that spoke into my young life in most every venue where I sat at the feet of those who would teach me their powerful ways, this inescapable message was always sounded, Wyatt, you gotta love. Love first, love pure, love to the bitter end. And I got to say, all these years later, I agree. Not once, not even in my teen years when I thought I knew everything, not once did I ever think, well, love's not worth it. I don't want to, so I'm not going to love anybody but me. I'd rather be a self-centered, bitter, angry, discriminating, sociopathic, oozy-toting people hater than waste my life showing love. Now, I've always believed, and I believe more now than ever, that those who modeled for me their love and sang their ditties and preached their sermons, I've always believed, and I still do, that they were right, that love really is the only way to live. However, can you handle a slice of transparency from your pastor? Because even though I've always agreed with the concept of love, and though I've basked down to my toenails in the incredible, all-encompassing love that Jesus has showered all over me, though I've always wanted to love other people for His sake, if for no other reason, I stand before you frustrated because no matter how I try, I'm just not the loving person I wish I was. The one that you who only see me up here think I am. I wish I was, but I'm not. And I think I finally figured out why. It's because it's really hard to love other people when there's such a shortage of lovable people. Really, just look around. Don't make eye contact. But you know it's true. Our world is broken, right? A ship floating adrift, filled with maladjusted, emotionally stunted people who have been mutated to such destructive levels. I mean, how can I love such morons? Don't get me wrong, I can love people who are like me because, well, I'm normal. But how come God made so very few as obviously put together as me? Dude, if everybody just pull their head out, grow up, shape up, and happy up, maybe this love thing could actually happen. Isn't it strange how nobody in your life is normal but you? And how everybody is a weirdly mutated wacko except you? And it's at that very point that love breaks down. Not in concept. Everybody agrees in concept that love is great. No, where love breaks down is when we actually embrace the challenge to love somebody. Especially if they're not normal, like me. That's when love is really tough. When the person that I'm supposed to love is obnoxiously different than normal me. I want to highlight just a few ways that we are different from one another. I could probably mention 400. I'm just going to give you four. So we're going to skip the surface stuff. One person has brown hair, another is blonde. That's not a biggie. If you're blue-eyed and I'm green, if you're kind of short and he's really tall, if one dude is right-handed and another is correctly handed, it's true. We can deal with those minor differences, but we're not nearly so tolerant when those same inbred genetically predetermined differences are expressed in our personalities or in our temperaments. For example, some people are introverts and others are extroverts. Have you noticed? And if you're married and your marriage is typical, you probably have one each, right? I don't know why, it just is. One of you craves social contact, the other is exhausted by social contact. One is energized by hanging with people, the other is drained. The extrovert loves parties, impromptu barbecues, reunions, and they love chatting it up in the lobby or over in the cafe after church. Meanwhile, wifey is holding up a wall somewhere just hoping he'll soon be done. It's not that she doesn't like people. She's just not like him. Now, the introvert, and I know because I am one, we crave alone time. Relax, unplug, and think time. So introverts, we don't really relax until everybody's gone. I mean, even if the introvert had a great time, it's only after the last guest leaves that the introvert can be himself and say, "Oh, I thought that would never be over." The introvert can't wait to go on vacation so it can be just us. Meanwhile, the extrovert is pacing the cruise ship going, "Hey, where are you guys from?" And the worst question ever, "Want to have dinner?" But invariably what happens is the extrovert makes the introvert feel guilty. Am I right? Because why aren't you more like me? You need more friends. I'm telling you, little social contact, it won't hurt you. Meanwhile, the introvert's going, "What's the matter with me as me? How come you can't be content with who I am?" And that's where love breaks down. Here's another way we're different. Some people love to dream dreams, and others are driven by the bottom line. Anybody here married to a dreamer? Okay, a couple. Doesn't get bogged down by details. He's a big picture, visionary guy. Constantly thinking of better ways to do stuff. Don't bother him with fact sheets or demographic analyses. The dreamer says, "You trust me, I got a feeling about this." Meanwhile, the bottom liner is going, "Dude, I'll trust you, but I need facts. Give me data. I'll do a spreadsheet, draw up some charts, maybe a detailed cost analysis, and then after the numbers line up, then maybe I'll trust you." One leader says in every organization there's a 10-80-10 setup. The first 10%, any organization, are the innovators. Crowd that's always looking for new ways to do stuff, better ways, easier ways, cheaper ways. And innovators love ideas. They enjoy taking risks. It's not that we're irresponsible. We just get stoked trying to do stuff that radically could fail. And typically, the stronger the leader, the more effective the leader, the more innovative he or she is. But in the process of doing innovative things, innovators make a lot of enemies. Have you noticed? Why is that? Because 80% of any organization is populated by maintainers. Maintainers don't really like change, but they will change if you give them enough reason to change. If you provide enough corroborating evidence and there's a reasonable expectation that this thing will succeed, they'll go along. And there's nothing wrong with maintainers. Every organization needs those very steady, dependable workhorses. Besides, if a church or any group is made up of only innovators, that organization's going to go broke, probably sooner than later. But an organization of only maintainers will be boring, it will lack vision, and never inspire anybody to greatness. Now, the final 10% are the inhibitors, and these are those who will not change regardless. Don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up. And if the leadership of a church or any organization is primarily populated by inhibitors, that organization is also doomed. So, maybe you're married to an innovator. One way you can tell is if you ask what he wants to do today or next week on vacation, and he says to you, "I don't know, let's just figure it out as we go." You're probably married to an innovator. Problem is, you're a maintainer, and so you're thinking, "Dude, just tell me the plan, because I got a plan. Hotel reservations, got to get a sitter for the dog, what are we going to do with the kids?" Most innovators like to put stuff from IKEA together without using the instructions. Meanwhile, the maintainer is watching all the fumbling and bumbling and going, "Here's instructions, use them." And the innovator is going, "Why use them when I can figure it out on my own?" Which way is the right way? Your answer will tell you who you are. But the truth is, there is no one right way. There are just different ways. God ordained differences, not right or wrong. We actually need both. Here's a third difference. Some by nature think with our heads first, while others feel with our hearts first. So which one are you? Are you a thinker? Or are you a feeler? When it's crunch time, do you make the call based on objective data, or do you impulsively respond according to gut instinct? Now, neither approach is omnipotent. And yet, whichever one I am, that's the normal one. Are you with me? Here's another difference. Some folk plan every detail of their lives. Others enjoy playing it by the ear. Have you ever noticed that difference in your relationships? There are some people in your world that require a very orderly, neat existence. Everything is known. Nothing is left to chance. For that kind of person, change, any change at all, creates anxiety. Because rules and policies, that's what makes life ordered. You love deadlines, and without fail, you meet your deadlines. And so you schedule everything. I mean, you're Sheldon Cooper, okay, who not only schedules his own, but his roommate's bowel movements as well, right? Meanwhile, there are other really weird people in your life. You still got to love them, but they just kind of muddle through, and they have no structure at all. You know anybody like that? So loosey-goosey, laissez-faire, laid back. Makes you want to hurl. How can you love somebody that messed up? Well, believe it or not, we are now ready for John chapter 6. Grab a Bible, because so far in this study, we've watched Jesus actively doing what I've been told my whole life that I need to do. Namely, love people, even people who are maladjusted and mutated. Except Jesus did it. And in no passage quite like this passage is Jesus' uncanny ability to love people more on display than John chapter 6. Chapter begins with this, sometime after this. Now, at the risk of upsetting you maintainers, I got to call time out. Because that phrase begs a question for this innovator. Sometime after what? Besides, before we can appreciate what comes next, we probably ought to know what came before. We don't have time to turn, but Matthew tells us that this was the same day that Jesus found out that his first cousin, his best friend, his faithful forerunner, John the Baptist, had been beheaded. So he's grief-stricken. And because he's to some degree an introvert, he needed to get away. So he climbs into a boat and he heads to the distant shore, one time away from people so he could grieve. Not only that, Mark tells us that the disciples had just returned from their first preaching assignment. Now, you kind of have to be a preacher to really get this, but after you preach your first sermon, there is no exhaustion quite like that exhaustion. Because no matter how well you did or didn't do, you think you stunk up the place. I remember back when I preached my very first full-length 35-minute sermon. I did it in just under 7.2 minutes. And yet my shirt was drenched, my mind spinning like a CD, my body limp as a dish rag, wrung around, rinsed through, draped over, hung out to dry. Thought I'd never preach again. So trust me, the disciples too, they wanted what Jesus wanted. They wanted left alone. And yet a great crowd of people followed them. A crowd so big they counted only the men when they sat down, though there were others. Families were there. So if you add in women and children, there could have been as many as 20,000 people on that hill. And all of them wanted a piece of Jesus. Can't you just picture those disciples just rolling their eyes? Even huge size. Kind of like the way you respond when you're binge watching your favorite TV show and mom calls. You consider declining, but then you clear your throat and go, "Hi, Mom." Well, that wasn't the disciples' response, but it was Jesus' response. Matthew says that when he saw the crowd, he had compassion on them. Talk about gracious. You ever been in a similar spot? You're tired, just want to be left alone, don't want to talk, don't want to be nice, just want some downtime. So you pour some tea, grab your tablet, lean back in a chair, and the doorbell rings. Or one of the kids has yet another crisis. You ever been there? If you've ever grumbled in a moment like that, you know where Jesus and the disciples were coming from. But Matthew doesn't leave it to our imagination. He tells us that as evening approached and as it became obvious that everybody up on that hill was really, really hungry, the disciples' first inclination, shocker, let's send everybody home. Let them get their own food, Jesus. But catch the nuance here, because it says when Jesus looked up, he saw the crowd. Don't miss that. Jesus wanted downtime too. He had some powerful grieving that needed expressed. And yet, unlike his disciples who pretended not to see, because to them, their needs were primary, Jesus was the only one who looked up, and when he did, he saw a need that needed met, and so he motioned for the people to come near. But here's what else I see. Jesus never does rebuke his men for not doing it the way he did it. There's no hint here that he's disappointed or frustrated. As far as I can tell, he doesn't even pull the typical extrovert stunt and criticize them for wanting a little alone time. No, all I see is Jesus stretching his men. Doesn't expect them to be just like him. In fact, even though they were at best an inferior mutation of his likeness, he uses them anyway to pull off what is, by every account, one of the greatest miracles of all time. In fact, it's the only miracle, if you didn't know this, besides the resurrection of Jesus, that is mentioned in every one of the four Gospels. So here's how it happened. Jesus starts first with Philip. Bottom line, Philip. And he says to Philip, "We're not going to send these people home. We're going to feed them." He looked up, saw the crowd, and said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for all these people?" Talk about an innovator. He has unknowingly been followed by 20,000 people up a remote hillside on the backwoods of Bethesda. And he decides to throw an impromptu dinner party. That's enough to make any bottom liner have an anxiety attack. But before you melt down, check it out. He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. "Well then, Jesus, why don't you just snap your fingers and get it done instead of giving your management team ulcers?" Everybody's suddenly scrambling to find something or do something or cook something, even though Jesus already knew what he was going to do. See, Jesus used this moment to stretch Philip, not to mock him, not to make fun of him, not to embarrass him, but to teach him a valuable lesson. By the way, let's pause and remind every bottom liner in the room, God always knows what he's going to do. And even if right now you can't connect the dots, he already has. God knows how your story is going to end. He knows when your life is going to turn around. You don't, I don't, but he does. In fact, even before you knew there was a problem, God had a solution. So, like you, Philip had no clue Jesus was stretching him. All he sees is this giant problem that innovative Jesus has just dumped in his lap. "Where are we going to buy bread, Phil?" Philip probably thought, "What you mean we, Tonto?" If he did, he didn't say it. Smart. But what he did say was 8 months' wages wouldn't buy enough bread for even one bite. Hey, Jesus, you're talking where. The real issue is how. As in, how do you expect to pay for all that food? Do you realize, Jesus, we've got 20,000 people up here. One man would have to work almost a whole year, and that's just for everybody to get one lousy Twinkie. Philip is a classic bottom liner. And that's why some of you get him. Because you, too, live in the realm of logic. For you, it's always about the bottom line. You calculate the possibilities. You execute your plan based purely on the merits of your math. And although logic is God-given, it is not a very accurate tool when it comes to factoring in the infinite power of God. A far better response would have been, "Lord, you're the only one who can do this, and I got no idea how you're going to do this, but I know you can." But for whatever reason, Philip just couldn't go there. Felt like some of us probably feel that this situation I'm facing right now is the first problem in human history to bend the limits of the abilities of God. Isn't it amazing how we go there? We think that my current predicament, this is the first moment that extends beyond the reach of God. My financial situation, the first one, not even God can recover. And my health, too far God for God even to heal. And my marriage, so irreparably damaged, not even God can restore this mess. And so just like Philip, we limit God because, well, it's logically impossible. Even though God is able and can provide resources from unexpected sources. Our God can heal when doctors say there's nothing else that can be done. He can restore a home in ways that just make no sense at all. Whatever the situation of your life that you're currently facing, please understand, you are not outside the reach of God. You are not now, nor will you ever be the first one to reach the limits of His power. You're not. Maybe it doesn't seem possible to you right now, but don't ever forget, what seems impossible to you isn't even remotely difficult for Him. But again, Jesus isn't shaking His head in disgust. He's not angry. No, in spite of Philip's inability to think with any degree of creativity or trust, Jesus finds a way to use him. But before I show you how, let me tell you about another key player, Simon Peter's brother, Andrew. And what I really find intriguing about Andrew is that while Philip is crunching numbers, Andrew is milling about the crowd. It's almost like Andrew heard Jesus say, "We're going to feed these people." And so he immediately starts searching for, I don't even think he knew what he was searching for. But the point is, Philip was immobilized by the obstacle, whereas Andrew was energized by the need. What can he do? He's got no clue. But what he can do, he does. He's looking for food. Gotta admire that man. Not belly aching, not conjuring up 47 reasons why this feast can't happen. He's looking for a way to make it happen. Like Philip, he feels the impossibility of the plan, but instead of focusing on the impossibility, he's looking for something, anything he can grab hold of. So he starts combing the crowd. Now, I don't know what he's thinking, but he finds this little runt of a kid with an even smaller lunch pail, and he says to himself, "Self, this ain't much, but it's a start." Now, I understand, to you statistical pessimists, that sounds negative, doesn't it? This is ridiculous. And yet it happened. Andrew somehow talks this kid into coughing up his lunch, comes back to Jesus, still out of breath, and says, "Here's a boy, he's got 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish." Now, actually in the text, there ought to be, right here, a comma. I wish there had been a period instead of a comma. Because I want Andrew to stop while he's ahead. "Jesus, got something. Think you can work with it. Don't know what you'll do. Don't much care. But here, go for it, Jesus." It's almost like Andrew was trying so hard to believe, to listen to his heart instead of his head. But by the time he got back to Jesus, his mind had kicked back into gear, and he felt foolish for holding on to a little lunch sack. And I get it, but I still wish he'd said, "Lord, here's some fish. Have at it." "Watch this, kid. You ain't going to believe this. Stand back now or you're going to get food on you." But he doesn't. Instead, Andrew keeps yapping. "But how far will they go among so many?" It's so easy to be shot down by the odds and to give up on a perfectly good plan just because somebody points out the scarcity of your resources. Because that's when Satan invades a heart and douses your spirit with despair. "You're going to do what? Can't do that." Don't you know, child of God, what you have is all God needs. This kid had 5 Triscuits and a couple of anchovies. But the Lord was in it. And when God is on your side, you're always in the majority. When the Lord is engaged in your life, the deck is never stacked against you. So stop thinking with your head. Feel with your heart. Like General Joshua did when he led those band nerds out of retirement to play 3rd trumpet in his Jericho parade. And as they played, the army didn't shoot, they shouted. I mean, what self-respecting army shouts when you could shoot? But they did, and that's how the wall fell. Or Samson, remember when a few thousand Philistines jumped him? And so he grabs whatever he could grab, the jawbone of a donkey, in fact, and whoops the whole bunch of them. Doesn't complain because he doesn't have an Uzi. He just grabs what he could find, and with the help of God, he cleaned their clocks. Or David, standing before huge Goliath with a little leather strap and 5 smooth stones. His own people said, "David, he's too big to hit." David said, "Nah, he's too big to miss." And he didn't. Something miraculous and mysterious happens when you and I take whatever little we've got and we lift it as a gift and offer it wholly to our God. A little boy's lunch looks like a paltry gesture until you remember that little is much when God is in it. So focus on what you do have. because what you have is all God needs. A shouting army, a donkey's jawbone, a stone, and a sling. The real question isn't, will it make a difference? The question is, will you make it available? Because it's only when you lift it up and when you offer it to God that God can do with it what only God can do. And the one person in this story who stands in support of that kid, that little kid, the only one who came prepared, his mama was the only mama who had worked the whole day to scrape a meal together. In fact, I think had she known what her kid was up to, how many of you think she would have approved? There's not a mom alive who's thrilled when her kid ditches his lunch. Mom packs him up, kids toss him out. Except this kid did way more. He offered his only relief for his own hunger to Jesus. How much of his lunch did he let go? All of it. Gave everything he had. And that little snack pack was all Jesus needed. But what surprises me most, and I just saw this week, is Jesus took it. You see it in the text? One kid, and his mama was the only mama who planned ahead, and Jesus, instead of saying, as I think I would have said, thanks, kid, but you know, that's your lunch. We'll be fine. Your mama would want you to eat your lunch. No. Jesus took it. The text seems to suggest the kid didn't even actually release his lunch as much as Jesus took his lunch. But by the end of the story, because he lost what he thought he needed, because he gave it up, this kid ended up eating far more lunch, having had it taken from him, than he ever could have had, hoarding it all for himself. Please, don't forget that. He let go of the food. And after it was gone, he had a great feast. And not only was he filled, everybody else on that hill was also filled. Now I know you know this story. Pretend you've never heard it before. Because Jesus said, have the people sit down. And the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. According to Mark, Jesus had them sit in specific groups, so there's some kind of a seating chart. And once seated, Jesus took the loaves and he gave thanks. Thanks for what? You got to know that's what bottom line Philip is thinking. All right, men, let's bow our heads and return thanks. For what, Jesus? One measly sack lunch and 20,000 moochers and you're giving thanks? Absolutely. And having given thanks, Jesus gave it to those who were seated. And they did the same with the fish. Now Matthew says that he gave the food to the disciples and then the disciples gave the food to the people. In other words, he used the 12 as his ushers. All right, guys, let's fire up this feedback. But Jesus, we won't get past the first row. Well, then feed the first row. And they probably broke off just the tiniest little pieces, hoping to stretch this snack box as far as possible. Sorry, ma'am, just one crumb. That's all you get. But then they got to the end of the first row, and by George, by Jesus, they had enough for a second row. And then third row. And that's when Peter, you got to know it was big mouth Peter, screamed, woo, all you can eat tonight, everybody, dinner! Did they ever? Till everybody had as much as they wanted. Matthew says they were satisfied. They stuffed themselves, couldn't eat another bite. And when they'd all had enough to eat, Jesus said, gather the pieces that are left over, let nothing be wasted. And so they did, and they filled, 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. Okay, Philip types, help me out here. How many ushers were there? Okay, how many baskets were there left over? That would be one each. Okay, a basket was roughly the size of a backpack, and each of the 12 got one. And as they lugged that puppy home and munched on leftovers for the rest of the weekend, the lesson came even more sharply into view. The size of my need should never be measured by what I have to offer. Because what I have, it'll never be enough. Besides providing for my need, that's God's job, not mine. I'm simply called to give to Him the little I've got, even if it's two crackers and some guppies. There's an old Greek mythology about a Cyprian king named Pygmalion. Maybe you read about him in school. Not only was Pygmalion the king, he was a sculptor. Rather disgusted with his life, though, because he hadn't found the woman of his dreams, even though he had looked through the entire kingdom. So being a sculptor, he bought the finest chunk of ivory he could find, and out of that ivory he sculpted a woman, the woman of his dreams. He made her exactly as he imagined his ideal woman would look like and fantasized about what her personality would also be. When he finished, he put the chisel away, bowed to his knees, and he prayed. And lo and behold, that ivory became a living being. My, how the king loved her. And they were married and lived happily ever after. What a cool story. Easy to see why that legend has stood the test of time, right? I mean, who wouldn't want a shot at custom designing your own spouse? Or child? Or boss? What a kick. Start with a clean slab of ivory and shape it just as I want it to be. Man, I could love like I've always wanted to love. If I could just chisel away all the blunt edges and remove all those differences that I find so off-putting, strange, and mutated. Given that, I'd be a lover to end all lovers. See, here's the problem. You are not my Pygmalion project. And so the more I pound away at you, the more you resent me and resist every attempt on my part to change you. You plead with me, please, put the chisel away. I don't want to be recreated in your image. If God wanted me to be just like you, He would have made two just like you. But instead, in God's infinite wisdom, He decided not to inflict two of you on the rest of the world. He made one of you, and He made one of me. So I got an idea, honey. You be you. I give you permission. Be you. But doggone it, let me be me. That's the first lesson of this story. Since God made us as we are, and since God doesn't make any mistakes, we need to affirm our differences. We need to appreciate the unique personalities of those with whom we work and relate. And no matter how difficult your spouse or friend may be, or how perverted or severely mutated your husband may be, you need to learn to say to him or to her, I love you just as you are. You are way different than me. I'm starting to like it. I'm thinking maybe God wrapped you just fine. Anybody here? Don't raise your hand. Tired of being somebody else's stupid piece of ivory? Anybody wearied by all the constant hammering? Got a great old piece I want to read for you. It's called The Animal School. Once upon a time, the animals decided to do something heroic to meet the problems of a new world. So they organized a school, adopted an activity curriculum consisting of running, climbing, swimming, and flying. To make it easier to administer, all the animals took all the subjects. The duck was excellent in swimming, better, in fact, than his instructor, and made excellent grades in flying, but was quite poor in running. Since he scored low in running, he had to stay after school and eventually dropped swimming so he could practice running. This continued until his webbed feet were badly worn and he became only average in swimming. But average was acceptable in school, and so nobody worried, except the duck. The rabbit started at the top of the class in running but had a breakdown because of so much makeup work in swimming. The squirrel was excellent in climbing till he was reprimanded in flying class because his teacher wanted him to start from the ground up instead of from the treetop down. Got charley horses from overexertion wound up with a C in climbing and a D in running. The eagle was a real problem, had to be disciplined severely, because in climbing class he beat the others to the treetop, but insisted on using his own method of getting there. By the end of the year, an abnormal eel that could swim exceedingly well and also could run, climb, and fly a little had the highest average and was valedictorian. What's the point? God made you as He wanted you. So be whoever you are. Celebrate the fact that you are wired as God intended to wire you. The great challenge of your life is to run straight to wherever Jesus is and hide in His covering shadow, and not allow yourself to be recreated into anybody else's image of what they think you ought to be. No, you need to be the best you God made you to be. I'm not saying that you should be stubbornly resistant to any and all change. I'm not saying that you're fine just as you are and there's no need for any self-improvement, because you are so put together, baby. No, we all have improvements and adjustments that need to be made, just like those disciples. Understand, if the world was going to get reached by those same 12 men, they were all going to have to become way less reclusive and way more engaged with people. And Philip, even though numbers would always be important, Philip needed to be way less enamored with spreadsheets and way more impressed with God. And Andrew, he needed to learn to trust more than his own instincts. He needed to trust in Jesus. And though Jesus was committed to seeing all of those changes happen, the beauty of the story is Jesus loved them just as they were. See, if you really love somebody, you want them to be everything they can be, right? Then again, if you really do love them, what they are right now, well, that's okay too. So Jesus stretched these men as they walked in His shadow. He did it in a context of acceptance. And it was there in the shadow of His wings, in that awesome, protective environment of radical love, that they were empowered to make needed change. It's where He proved Himself to be the master of taking insignificant nothings and transforming them into amazing, breathtaking miracles, which is the last lesson. That God, being who He is big enough to use whatever we have to offer. The disciples, instead of belly aching about what they didn't have, they made available what they did have and discovered to their delight that what they had was all God needed. Jesus was so beyond able with only what they had. I mean, He didn't actually need Philip's advice. He already knew what He was going to do. But He used that moment to stretch Philip. He didn't need Andrew combing the crowd either. He could have sent manna from heaven. I think He'd done that before. And that kid, he didn't need that kid's lunch. He took it. But even Satan knows Jesus could have made bread out of rocks had He wanted to. Certainly didn't need the disciples as His cleanup crew. He just wanted to teach Him. And through this passage, us, a very powerful lesson. When you let Jesus do your life His way, marvelous things happen. The whole point of this story is that it was Jesus on that mountain. And He cast over that high place a long, expansive shadow that encompassed every single need. So it really doesn't matter how mutated you may be feeling in this moment right now. If you are in Christ, He is in your camp. And He loves you with a radical love, just as you are. So you may think, and others may also think, that you're nothing much more than a zero. But as long as this story is on the biblical record, you need to celebrate the you that God made you to be. You need to take that tiny little measly little scrawny little sack of nothing you got in your hands, and you need to place it in His hands, and then step back and watch as Jesus alone does what only God can do. Would you pray with me? Jesus, it is beyond amazing to me how this story, just looked at through a different facet, is so revealing how you get your work done through people as messed up as we are. God, I'm thankful for the incredible, amazing love that you shower down on me just as I am. You stretch me to be more, but you love me as I am. Father, in this broken world, help us love that same way. Loving the people who are different than I am. The one we work with. The person who has a faith that is different than mine. That snarly person at the coffee shop. Give me the capacity to love even as Jesus loved. It's in His name we pray. Amen.